Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Spencer Scheffler, and I'm here to talk to you today about Azure Stack and its architecture, bringing what we run in those data centers to you on-premise in a way that you can take advantage of the software that we run, maintain, and can deliver to you for your services. So I've got my email address up here just as kind of a bit of housekeeping, Twitter handle just as reference, and I'll put those up towards the end. So let's get started. So the first thing is that a little bit of a plug for the work we've done to bring Azure Stack into the expo hall. So we've got the private cloud solutions or hybrid cloud solutions booth downstairs. So go check this out. We've got the Dell, HP, and Lenovo solutions on the floor. You can talk to us about how those are put together. I'll be down there later this afternoon and tomorrow so I can answer questions as follow-ups. So reach out and talk to us. It wasn't a booth number specifically, but take a look at the hybrid cloud platform marquee and you'll find those solutions. So here's a picture of the ones that were on stage on Monday during Jason Zander's talk, and the booth numbers where you can go talk to those vendors about their solutions. So a little bit about timelines as well for housekeeping. So Azure Stack, if you've been to some of the other sessions and heard, so we're in the middle of technical previews. We released one at the beginning of the year. We've done TP2 at the first of this week. So you can pick that up and run that on a single server configuration. We'll continue to refresh that through technical preview 3 and on into GA in the middle of the year for multi-node solutions as a production workloads. So what is Azure Stack? I mean, what are we bringing to you on-premise? I'll go through a lot of the details underneath, but at the higher level, what we're doing is we're building, bringing those Azure services into your data center, into those solutions on-prem onto your hardware. So at the basic level, that's what we're up to. We're trying to provide that consistency so you can take your workloads, deploy them in Azure. You can take those workloads, deploy them on-prem in Azure Stack, move them back and forth for dev test, various regulatory reasons. There's a variety of reasons why you want to have the full ecosystem in place for Azure Stack, and that's what we're bringing together for you into your data center. A little bit into the details of what it is. So it's not just a software solution. We are providing, obviously, the software that we bring together that represents what Azure is, bringing that on-prem. And it's also a set of hardware that's been tested, configured to align essentially to the requirements, the things that I'll discuss this afternoon about how we put it together and what it means to the software layers, so making sure that we can actually maintain and service that along with you from a day-to-day standpoint. The set of support infrastructure, as we bring solutions together with our OEM partners, making sure that you get the right support, both from them and from us, so it's a complete solution and not just a handoff from one vendor to the other. And finally, there's going to be a set of services wrapped around these, essentially at your discretion, you know, rack and stack, bring it into the data center, get it deployed, and if you want, probably ongoing services as well as we define and understand what our customers need. So I'll go through and describe essentially kind of what the hardware stack looks like, but it is a hardware and software solution, and that's how you acquire Azure Stack. And the phrase we use is an Azure Stack integrated system. And that's a full life cycle of services that come together. It's not just how do I install the software and I leave and forget it. We try to account for all the different pieces of the solution over time. So obviously, first we go through and we think about what the architecture should be, what the underpinnings of the hardware, Windows Server, and then all the services on top of that, what that really has to come together to deliver the scale, performance, and availability for you as a customer to run the Azure services on top of that. Deployment configuration, we work through our OEM partners, we engage with customers to understand how they deploy services in their data center, making sure that we can accommodate essentially the variety of environments, configurations, and the needs for what we're putting together. So that's another big piece of what we're trying to do. Validation is a big piece of what we do, obviously for our own software, but we also work with our hardware partners to ensure that we get the right feature and function out of the hardware components, all the way from HBAs, NICs, storage devices, servers, network switches, through the whole stack, so that you can be assured that when you're getting an integrated system, that those components have come together, individually been tested, but been tested as a whole as that overall solution. Monitoring and diagnostics, obviously, if I'm going to take on a large system. I have to understand what's going on. You have to be able to see what's happening. What do I need to react to? How do I put together in my existing environment? And how do I integrate that into the things that I do from day to day? Field replacement parts are FRUs. Obviously, things are going to fail, hardware, software. We need to be able to account for that. And that's really, again, as a partnership. We have a certain idea and capability in our software stack, but our OEM partners have their own supply chains, support infrastructure, bringing those together in a way that we can actually deliver that and make sure that it satisfies the overall SLAs for the solution. Patching and updating, looking at how we deliver software on a regular cadence so that we can keep up with delivering the consistency with Azure, providing services, security patches, firmware updates, essentially the whole set of things that we have to take advantage of, and doing that in a way that's non-disruptive to the workloads that are running on top of an Azure Stack instance. Business continuity, things like backup, disaster recovery, how are those integrated to the solution? It's another large piece of what we look through from day to day. And then finally, the security practices, how we do deployment, how we manage it and bring it together for you in your environments and making sure that it meets the requirements of the enterprise, service delivery partners, and a variety of other entities that have to be involved with ensuring that we have a secure platform to work from. So this is the whole life cycle, or the way we think of the life cycle structure for Azure Stack. And it actually is a pretty good guide for the overall agenda that we have for today and the topics that I'll go through and spend time on. The majority of my time is going to be focused on kind of that architecture, the hardware and the topology characteristics of Azure Stack, the things we're building for the initial release in the middle of next year. So it's really about that as a focus, and I'll touch on the other subjects a little bit because we have other sessions either later today or tomorrow. I have a session list at the end where we'll go into some more of that detail. And again, if there are questions or follow-ups, see us in a booth, make sure that you get the questions answered. And even after the show, my email's there. There's a lot of other of us here in the sessions you can reach out to and get answers. So let's start talking a little bit about the architecture. So as a little bit of an overview, this is kind of a classic, block diagram of the architecture, starting off at the very top of the consistency with Azure. So we have the Azure portal, the templates, being able to interact with PowerShell and the way we're managing the overall topology of Azure and Azure Stack. And then the Azure Resource Manager is an instance that runs in Azure Stack. So essentially, this is the endpoint that you interact with as both a tenant and administrator of an Azure Stack instance. So this is key to the overall delivery. Underneath that is an architectural layer, is a partition request broker. We have a variety of acronyms listed underneath that. All of them refer to essentially a resource provider. So there's a well-known API that interacts back and forth with ARM. Just like Azure does, the architecture is exactly the same. Then underneath that, we have essentially the variations that start to occur because our architecture, unlike the massive data center in the video that I showed you at the very beginning, is going to be 4 servers to start with. So we have to take the software that runs in that data center in some form, provide the consistency of Azure, and bring it onto a 4-node configuration to start. And so this represents essentially the underlying pieces where the variance starts to happen from an Azure standpoint. Now, this is all underlying detail. This is an infrastructure that we're providing and isn't externally exposed to you through a set of APIs. You're not going to see that when you go off to deploy workloads as a tenant or administer the overall server solution. Within the infrastructure, then the hardware layer that underlies all this, so network compute and storage is an underlying feature or set. And then the details of essentially kind of what's inside that infrastructure role. So one of my coworkers likes to refer to that long list of things. So if you're going to open up the task manager in Windows on your desktop, and you see a bunch of services running, it's like you may know what those are, but you don't really have to get into the details of how to manage them. You know that they're present. You might have to stop and restart them occasionally. But the idea is that those are well-engineered, tested, validated, and you really don't need to interact with them or know essentially kind of those overall details. And so that's what's represented in those roles. And as I mentioned today, we'll focus on the network switches, compute and storage configurations, and the choices we've made to deliver essentially Azure Stack overall for your data center. So what is an Azure Stack instance or installation? So if we look at that, kind of refer back to that ARM instance, we have a single instance of ARM that manages or essentially is that portal for the instance of Azure Stack. Then you can have one or more regions underneath it. And I'll go through and talk about that a little bit more. But it's the same concept that holds for Azure. So if I have a data center in US West, that shows up as a place where I can deploy resources. If I have a data center in US East, I can deploy resources there. And the same thing is going to happen with Azure Stack. You'll have those regions present under ARM and be able to manage those as a single entity, if you will, of Azure Stack. Underneath one of those, each of those regions, there'll be one or more scale units. I'll go through and define what those are. But you can think of them as a group of compute and storage resources and networking resources that interact together in a tightly bound fashion or delivered essentially as a unit or whole. And that's, you're going to have one or multiple of those within a region to provide you scale. And then within each scale unit, we're going to start off with four servers. And I'll go through the logic behind why that's the case, why we start off with four instead of one or two, and what the resiliency model is for that, and how we think about capacity expansion starting off from that four server unit. So an Azure Stack region represents essentially that group of scale units as I talked about. And typically in the same physical location. You know, you're going to have a set of racks of equipment. If I've got some reasonable scale within a region, I'll have a set of racks, set of scale units. They're probably going to be underneath a single administrator. And so that these are in quotes because it's really up to the customer to decide kind of what those characteristics mean. We have essentially the underlying requirement for a region is that they have the network bandwidth and latency that match the expectations of what you'd see in Azure. So high bandwidth, very low latency, because you're going to have workloads that are going to be essentially deployed within that region and have the requirements that they're going to be able to interact very effectively. So what it comes down to it is that I have a network infrastructure, and I'll go through and describe what the requirements and what that configuration looks like. But that network infrastructure needs to provide that bandwidth and latency. So I'm not going to lay down, you know, a couple of 1 gig links between a couple of scale units within a region. I'm going to run, you know, 10 gig, probably multiple 10 gig configurations between those scale units to provide that. And then lastly, the other set of attributes that are associated with the region. So the nice thing about regions is it's a separation of physical hardware, as I mentioned. And so you as a customer can take and essentially apply whatever other attributes are meaningful to you as that customer. We're not going to define those for you, but examples might be I have two different lines of business. They're going to invest in hardware. But they want to be able to manage essentially who gets access to that hardware and who's going to deploy workload. But you, maybe as an administrator, really don't want to run multiple instances of Azure Stack. So I'll take one set of hardware and place that in one region. And I'll take a second set of hardware that's purchased by some of the line of business and place that in a second region and run that under a single instance of the ARM. And then you can create plans and offers that essentially users are restricted or tenants are restricted to a particular region when they go to do deployments. And so you've got that control and alignment with essentially what is an abstract concept to us, really isn't meaningful to us as a provider of Azure Stack, but you as a customer, you can do that alignment. Other things that are classic examples are that I have two regions and I would place them in two different data centers. I've got an application that's pushing data between them from a replication standpoint for disaster recovery, and I can physically separate those regions by hundreds of feet if they're different buildings, tens of kilometers if that's what I require for my business. So those are very quick examples of what that is. A little bit about the scale unit. As I mentioned, it's associated with a region. It's actually a single region, so when you deploy a scale unit, it's going to be consumed wholly by that region. There's no more than just a one-to-one correspondence between a scale unit and region. That's a unit of capacity expansion, essentially. I'll go into more detail. There's a few subtleties there, but you can think of it as if I need to expand capacity within a region, I'm going to add additional scale units to the overall configuration. Finally, there is an alignment with Azure from the concept of fault domains. When I go deploy workloads, I can choose in Azure a mechanism to place, say, two separate or three separate VMs or services in different fault domains. And the ARM templates allow for the expression of that, and the workloads will be placed in the appropriate physical location for that separation. So for Azure Stack, those fault domains align with what our scale units are. So this really great, again, way to model and think about physical location and the workloads that are placed across those physical entities. So it's a very easy way to essentially align kind of the visual tactile things about the physical scale units and how those logical workloads are going to get placed. And then finally, there's an alignment of kind of a hardware SKU as well. And again, I'll go through and describe this more, but and the reasons behind it. But you can think of a set of servers within a scale unit of being a homogeneous configuration. They have to have the same memory, CPU, and storage devices to accommodate for that. So let's go a little deeper, talk about what the scale unit, what the implementation details are. So first, we're built on top of Windows Server 2016. So we're using quite a few of the features that have been delivered, actually, this week as general availability for Windows Server in the Azure Stack, essentially, infrastructure. And so things like software-defined storage, software-defined networking, a lot of other advancements that have been added to Windows Server, and I'll go through in detail some of what those are. We're going to choose to use a hyperconverged configuration. It gives us a lot of flexibility about how we do deployment. It's very straightforward to reason about, and for initial release, this is what we're going to rely on. Also, we're going to use Windows Server Failover Clustering. If you're familiar with essentially our software-defined storage stack in the form of Spaces Direct, you'll know that it takes a reliance on Windows Server Failover Clustering. We also use the failover cluster as a way to manage VMs and ensure that they're either live migrated or restarted within the environment if there are failures. As I mentioned, Storage Spaces Direct. A set of servers within a scale unit are going to physically be attached to a set of top rack switches. It's actually a Tor pair or two of those individual switches, and I'll describe what those configurations are. And you can actually configure more than one scale unit or one failover cluster within a single Tor pair, and that's kind of the details of what goes underneath it. But just think of it as that I'm not going to have to deploy a Tor pair for every scale unit or essentially every compute storage configuration. There is a little bit of flexibility that we can accommodate, and I'll describe some of that as well. So the reason, so once we do all this, we can pull together the ability to expand capacity very easily. We start off very small related to a larger installation. So if I think about what we refer to as a disaggregated compute and storage configuration, those have to start much larger because I'm going to have essentially a storage unit and compute, and that's going to be larger from essentially a cost and structure standpoint, where a hyperconverged configuration can start at a much lower size. As I mentioned, we can use multiple scale units to give us not only a scale, but also separation of fault domains, and we do need to have that homogeneously configured across all of those servers. So kind of just give you an example with a few pictures. So if I'm going to stand up and configure four servers in that scale unit, they're each going to provide CPU, memory, network access, storage, and those are going to get consumed, or those resources will be consumed for Azure Stack. So let's put that into a Windows Server failover cluster. I can move VMs around. I can place workloads. And then I have that attached to a set of network switches that I described. So I've got an infrastructure services piece. So that slide that I showed you at the very beginning that talked about a set of infrastructure services, those are running in a set of VMs. In fact, everything in Azure Stack, with the exception of the underlying hypervisor for each of the individual servers and the storage space's direct storage fabric, are running in VMs. So we place actually quite a few VMs in the infrastructure. We use that as a way to create resiliency of those infrastructure services. So they're placed across all four servers in that minimum configuration. And as I expand capacity, additional scale units, increases the need for more infrastructure, but the percentage of infrastructure consumed across those physical servers decreases in percentage as I add more physical hardware to the configuration. So don't be worried about that. It may look like a large component of the hardware is going to be consumed by infrastructure, but that decreases as your solution scales. So it's not a linear progression. Next, we hold back a little bit of that compute and storage, compute and memory for patch and update. And I'll go through and describe the patch and update sequences. But the idea is that since we are thinking about the entire ecosystem or the entire life cycle of the product, we have to be able to essentially evacuate a host of all of its running VMs, essentially reimage that host and then bring it back into service, rebalance the storage, rebuild it, and then I can migrate my VM structures back onto that missing server. So we always have to hold essentially one server's worth of capacity for that patch and upgrade cycle. So that's consumed as well. And then finally, then I can run my tenant capacity on top of that. So that's where I'm going to put all the services that I deploy through the ARM portal and remaining onto the rest of the resources. So let's talk a little bit about Azure Stack from a compute standpoint. Now, we took a look at kind of refer back to the goal of Azure Stack is to provide consistency with Azure. And we do that in many different ways, and it exhibits itself. I've already mentioned essentially two of those. One is that we are aligned with the region concept with Azure. Second is that we have fault domains, so I can deploy workloads. The templates look the same that I deploy through ARM. They're going to deploy those workloads appropriately. The next thing is we're going to talk about VM sizes. So if I'm going to have a template that deploys a workload, I want those VM sizes to be available both in Azure and Azure Stack. And that's what we're doing. But we're not going to be able to provide all of those sizes. Because if you go look at the list of things that are in Azure, a lot of those things are aligned not only to generations of hardware, but unique hardware characteristics, things like InfiniBand for HPC workloads that run. Those are only available in certain regions. Some of the GPU SKUs that we've announced just recently in Azure, those will not be available initially in Azure Stack, so those VM sizes won't be available. So there'll be other attributes of VMs that we can't really satisfy initially in Azure Stack, so those won't be available when you talk about delivering the workloads, but we will have other consistencies. And over time, you can expect, just as we'll keep up with other Azure services that we deliver over time, which is the plan for essentially that kind of fast update cadence for Azure Stack, is that you'll start to see other VM sizes come into play as we figure out what the most popular sizes are, what the customer needs from a hardware alignment standpoint, because there will be flexibility in hardware choices. Even though there are going to be three vendors initially, each one of those will have flexibility in the vectors, you know, CPU, storage, and compute. So you can have some flexibility in what you buy. But we will provide A standard sizes, the D and DV2 sizes. So one comment that I'll make is that this set of VMs represents roughly about 80% of what we see deployed in Azure proper. So we believe that this captures a bulk of the use cases, and that's what we'll deliver, and then we'll, you know, strive to get feedback from our customers and, as I mentioned, expand that over time. So if you look at the hardware requirements for compute, I mentioned several times we'll start off with four servers that can grow, obviously. They'll be hyperconverged. We'll do a dual socket, essentially 8 cores per socket as a minimum, 256 gig min for each of those servers. It gives us enough capacity for the VM workloads, both for infrastructure and for tenant. And as I mentioned, each one of those configured servers have to be the same within that scale unit. So let's move on to a little bit more complex topic of networking. So I have both a hardware discussion in this context, but also a software, essentially a software-defined storage, or I'm sorry, software-defined networking pieces. And this slide represents the set of features that Windows Server 2016 has brought to software-defined networking. So if you go back and look for, there's two sessions that are occurring during this week that talk about the generic Windows Server SDN capabilities. If you look for the speaker, Greg Cosanza, you will find both of his sessions. One of them was yesterday, then he has one tomorrow. So I'm not going to go through the details of what this represents, but I can assure you that each one of these major categories represents a set of features that we're taking advantage of in Azure Stack. So we will be using a network controller. It's the thing that actually manages the individual policies based, you know, placed on vSwitches within each of the Hyper-V hosts. Obviously, virtual networking, network security is extremely important. You know, we're going to be doing firewalls and ACLs on each of those servers. We have the gateways, both as forwarding gateway and site-to-site gateway capabilities within the solution. Software load balancing at an L4 level, and then a lot of the performance improvements that we've seen come together with 10 and 40 gig networking we're taking advantage of. And one of the big ones we're taking advantage of is essentially that converged NIC capability that allows us to run RDMA for storage access and live migration workloads along with the virtualized tenant workload as well. So it gives us a big advantage to build off of. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the physical switch topology and kind of describe the architectural choices we've made as we think about putting together an Azure Stack solution. And the intent here is that we're providing both essentially that data transport for storage and tenant workloads, but also physical host control in the form of the BMC connections. And this is important because we do not only the initial deployment and control of the individual servers, but we also will do redeployment of servers in case one of those need that if they've failed. So if I lose a boot disk on a server, it has to be reinstalled. All of those servers services are contained within Azure Stack. So it's actually, you don't have to go off and install that server by yourself, figure out how to put it together. You essentially bring a new server in with a new boot disk, go back through the admin portal, give the IP address of the BMC for that server, and we will manage that server directly. So we'll go off and power cycle it, set it up for Pixie booting, re-image that server, bring it back into the cluster, and reconsume the individual storage devices. So it's important for us to have that BMC connectivity to each one of those servers as well. The other thing that we think about isn't just physical connectivity, but how do we provide resiliency in a way that we know that I can maintain a switch, meaning that if it fails or if I have to re-image that switch or reboot it for some reason, that I'm not going to lose access to the tenant workloads or disrupt the storage infrastructure since I'm in a hyper-converged configuration. So it's important for us to have resilient network interfaces on the switch, on the individual hosts, that I've got the performance in the form of a 10 gig interface at a minimum. Then I'm going to build on top of that with the switch independent teaming capabilities that we have in Windows Server 2016 and build up from there essentially with the dual switch configuration. So it gives me a great topology to go through and provide the, both the access but also the resiliency characteristics. So if I look at this from a picture standpoint, I have four servers. I have the two Tor switches, the BMC switch, and I have the various connections identified. So I've got my BMC connections. I have my two data connections from each of the servers. Those are spread across the two Tors. Then I have the BMC switch actually connected to each one of the Tors. So that gives me access self-contained within the solution, so I don't have to go to an outside switch to gain that physical host control that I talked about. And then finally, a key important thing is that I have this switch-to-switch connectivity as well. So this gives me the resiliency so that when I think about connecting those switches to a border device, then I have the ability to forego or essentially control network paths when I have an individual switch failure. Then if I want to scale out, then I'm going to add another scale unit. And when I do that, I have to have connectivity between each one of those scale units. That means that I have to add another layer of switching on top of that. So we refer to that as an aggregate switch. And this whole topology, essentially this mesh of connectivity between the aggregate switches and each one of the TORs in the solution, is referred to as an L3, flat L3 network. So each one of those TOR switches, that's at a layer 2 device, so meaning that there's a set of VLANs and a set of subnets that are there. But once I go northbound of those TOR switches to an aggregate device, either to another rack or outside of the solution, then I'm routing at a layer 3 level in the network. So that means that I've got, you know, great connectivity, it's easy to manage the devices, easy to connect up, and you know, if I'm expanding capacity, then I can add links, add those to the routing tables of the switches, and I can, you know, essentially have a resilient platform both for expansion but also for switch failure. Now I'll talk a little bit about the subnets that we have for, I've talked about physical infrastructure. So on that BMC side, I've got to do switch management. In Azure Stack, we won't do physical switch management in an automated fashion. It'll be essentially a manual process. So initial deployment will be set. And then any physical changes that need to be made to the switches are going to be a manual process. But the advances in the software-defined networking stack and Windows Server alleviate a lot of the day-to-day management that you might otherwise take on for the physical switches, and I'll describe that a little bit later. But I still need to get access to those physical switches. So I've got a subnet for that. I have a BMC subnet, so I'm going to go off and talk to the physical server, so that's over that subnet. And I have two subnets that are used for essentially the physical infrastructure. So I've got a generic infrastructure subnet that contains essentially the ability to do the Pixie boot and deployment. All of the Hyper-V hosts will do management infrastructure over that. The HNV, or the Hyper-V networking virtualization stack, will run over that infrastructure network. And then the other components, essentially the tenant workloads, will run over that same network as well. And so it's got quite a bit of capacity on it. And then finally, the storage subnet is separated. And the reason for this is that we have RDMA that we use for the storage fabric. And the RDMA configuration on the switches requires that that subnet be associated with another VLAN other than the default VLAN for the configuration. So we have to separate that out and make sure that we've got a separate VLAN for storage traffic so that when we go rack to rack, then that's managed appropriately. And then finally, the most important thing about that Azure Stack solution is I have a set of external virtual IP addresses that are essentially associated with that Azure Stack instance. And the reason those are separated out is because logically, network management, BMC, infrastructure, and storage does not have to be exposed to the tenant workloads, so meaning that the tenant should never see nor have access to any of those subnets. So the external VIPs in this instance provide that connectivity endpoints for an Azure Stack solution. And so to talk about those a little bit, you know, what are those? If I have an Azure Stack instance, then the arrows represent essentially each one of those virtual IP addresses that come in, start off with the tenant and admin portal, essentially that web interface. If you go down and get a demo from the team at the booth, you'll see what those look like, but I've got an IP address for each one of those. And then I have an IP address for the ARM portal, or essentially the ARM API surface that interacts with Azure Stack. The next set of IP addresses represent essentially additional Azure Stack services. So the Azure Consistent Storage, which essentially is the blobs, tables, and queues of Azure, those are behind a single VIP. I have Key Vault underneath another, and then ADFS and Graph as services will be under a sixth. So it represents that set of IP addresses for the solution. And then finally, I've got an inbound networking connection in the form of a site-to-site gateway. So if I'm going to set up a VPN connection to an Azure Stack instance, then I've got a VIP for that as well. And then obviously, I'm going to have a set of tenant IP addresses that come in on, you know, alongside that. And that's sized based on what your solution needs and how many tenant resources you think you'll put together. So. So the next slide is an eye chart, and I'm not going to go through in great detail, but it's supposed to represent, or it does represent, not supposed to, but it does represent how we actually inbound and outbound network traffic into essentially that software-defined networking layer. So if you look down at the very bottom over the beeping forklift, we have a transit network. So this transit network interacts directly with the network switch, and so I have a couple slides here soon that will demonstrate how we interact with the physical switches, but we have to make a transition from physical switch into the logical software-defined networking stack of Windows Server and then therefore Azure Stack. And so we do that over this transit network. So we essentially create a BGP relationship. If you're familiar with BGP, I'm going to route, essentially provide a next hop endpoint from the physical switch into our SDN stack, essentially as essentially that software load balancer or MUX that we have in the solution. So we have this transit network to do that work for us. So that content is routed through the vSwitch up to a set of VMs. If you remember, I talked about all the infrastructure runs in VMs, so I've got an SLB MUX, so that's a software load balancer MUX that runs in a VM, comes up through a vSwitch interface, hits that SLB, we find the virtual IP address that I talked about earlier, so I've got a tenant virtual IP address, comes up into the SLB has a mapping. It can either software load balance across a set of VMs or it can be directed mapping to a particular VM. So it essentially rewrites that network component, or essentially the network traffic, rewrites the headers, and forwards it back out over the HNV network. So this does essentially that forwarding exercise. So I've got that next hop coming from physical switch into the SLB, and then I bounce that back out to the physical VM. So that's kind of the interconnect that happens. The second red arrow refers to the generic Windows Server 2016 capabilities of doing forwarding gateways. So I can either do load balancing through the SLB or NATing through the MUX, or I can do a forwarding gateway to bring a full subnet in. And that's a Windows Server 2016 capability. So how do I make this? I talked about kind of that BGP relationship with the physical switch. And so these diagrams represent those transitions. So I've got an Azure Stack scale unit. I've got my Tor pair that exists. And I can think of that as like that's an individual solution. So those connections that go outbound at the top, that's to some border networking device, provides that connectivity and routability. So that's my hardware stack that I have. Now I have to go back and think about how do I write from or forward from the BGP, or essentially the forwarding router that's in the physical switch, how do I get that into the individual servers running that SLB MUX? So the SLB acts as actually as a separate BGP instance. So it's got its own ASN number, and that's actually one of the things that we ask for in deployment. So you create that relationship between the physical switch and the SLB. And so there's really, from a physical switch standpoint, it looks like just another switch in the configuration. So we do the interactions through that capability. Now, if I talk about multiple scale units, I want to be able to actually involve all the physical switches in that data translation or that data transfer for through forwarding. So I'm going to connect up the aggregate switches between the two scale units, as I described before. So it gives me resiliency, performance throughput, all the requirements that we have for Azure Stack regions. But I have to forward the content somehow. So meaning that if I lose an aggregate switch, say in that first rack, and routing starts to come in on the second one, then I have to be able to forward all the way through the whole infrastructure, meaning that I can't have essentially a separation or partitioning that occurs just because I lose one of the aggregate switches in the configuration. So I'm going to use BGP to accomplish that. So I have BGP on the second set of physical TORs. I have an SLB MUX that's deployed in that second physical location as well. So you can think of that every scale unit ends up with a VM that's running the SLB content. So that makes it not only scalable from a performance standpoint, but I can also be resilient to failures. So I can be resilient to failures to the VM, meaning the SLB itself, for some reason it gets restarted. That actually will happen during patch and update. So I have to be able to accommodate essentially those changes. Then I'll have physical switch failures. So that means if I have a failure at that aggregate switch like I talked about in the first rack or first scale unit, then I will essentially, the traffic will reroute through the second and we'll be able to make connectivity to the SLB in either of those racks. And once it hits the SLB, we rewrite it and then forward it out to the overall fabric. So it gives us the resiliency and scale that we need for the virtual networking functions. And you'll note that the BGP ASN number, if you're familiar with how those are used, in the SLB, those are the same ASN numbers. So for the physical switches, it looks to them like they're interacting with the same, essentially, physical or next hop topology. So for them, it's essentially, I can forward to either one of those SLB instances because they have the same identity, if you will, from a routing standpoint. And then for completeness, it turns out that each of the aggregate switches have their own BGP instance as well. So that gives us essentially that resiliency all the way through the stack, both physical to logical or in the SDN. And then you can think of the overall solution, that yellow dotted box is essentially that Azure Stack integrated solution. And I've got two endpoints that come out and connect to networking border devices for the on-prem installation. So if you look at the requirements for the Azure Stack NICs and switches, so it's a minimum of 10 gig. We're going to do dual-ported NICs because I want the resiliency for switch and NIC failures, cable failures. We're going to be using RDMA in the form of either iWARP or RoCE v2. So that's a key component to the storage substrate that we use in Space Direct, and I'll talk about that in the next section. We're going to use the converged NIC features, as I mentioned before. So this gives us the ability to take one NIC, do RDMA, and all of the SLB and other offloads that we have for the software-defined networking stack. And then finally, the physical switches, they're required to have BGP, obviously, given the last discussion. Data center bridging capabilities, we're going to use ETS, essentially, to segment traffic and to put it into different traffic classes appropriately. PFC for flow control to the physical switches, that's an RDMA enablement. And then we need switch-independent teaming, and that refers to essentially that switch-to-switch connectivity that exists and the ability of those to be able to forward content between them. So let's move on to the storage capabilities. So with Spaces Direct in 2016's release, well, actually in 2012 and 2012 R2, the right-hand side of this diagram is how we've always deployed Spaces. It's meaning that I'm going to have a scale-out file server, and I'm going to run a bunch of Hyper-V hosts that are running in, say, a cluster, and I'm going to interact with those through the SMB3 protocol. And we've gotten great performance and scale, and the resiliency is really good with that. But with Spaces Direct in 2016, then we've added another major scenario in the form of hyperconverged. So we've used the same underlying technology. So we're using storage spaces as the ability to aggregate a set of physical storage devices into a logical pool. Then I carve out virtual disks with that. Then I use SMB as essentially an underlying transport with RDMA to get me fantastic performance to individual servers and provide the essentially one view of the physical storage devices. So the hyperconverged configuration for Azure Stack is really important because it gives us the scale units and the scale that we need for additional deployments, and we can grow very effectively as we need to is from an expansion standpoint. So what is in the storage stack? So I mentioned, you know, we're going to choose the hyperconverged configuration. We're going to use clustered shared volumes and REFS. So one of the big changes in 2016 in investments was that we've done quite a bit with REFS to add features for scale, performance, the ability to do quick snapshots. And we've created a use or dependency between REFS and a feature I'll talk about later in support of the blobs, tables, and queues that Azure Stack provides. So there's essentially a tie that goes on there. So we use REFS as a way to manage that and do very good work with the VHD management. Storage spaces, we're going to use a single pool of storage devices. Gives us great management and capacity expansion that we need for essentially to ease the overall management of an Azure Stack instance. Multiple virtual disks we get, so we can either do a mirrored or a parity configuration. Gives us a lot of flexibility with respect to either performance or capacity requirements that we have for the solution. And then, like I said, we're going to use SMB3 and SMB Direct as a way to take advantage of the hardware offload so we can get really great performance and scale. And I'll take a moment to talk about the fact that if you go down to the show floor, you can start with the booth that's right next to where the hybrid cloud platform solutions are. There's a set of examples of Spaces Direct configurations. And there's quite a few companies that are demoing Spaces Direct in all flash configurations. So we're seeing multiple millions of IOPS in either four nodes or more. So it's been really fun to see that. And then we've also seen great throughput work with Spaces Direct. So meaning if I take a four-node cluster, I know of one configuration, we do a four-node cluster with NVMe devices and a set of VMs that run on each one of those four servers. And in aggregate, with a read-only workload, we're able to get more than 80 gigabytes a second in throughput up to those VMs, which I think is unmatched at this point in the industry from a hyperconverged standpoint. And I'll make a plug now and at the end of the session, but at 4 o'clock this afternoon, there's a presentation on Spaces Direct that I highly recommend because they'll go through and describe in a lot more detail and probably more eloquently than I am about how it all gets put together, what the advantages of Spaces Direct generically are, and you'll see the ties between how we're using it in Azure Stack and the capabilities that they built in Windows servers. So it's a really great session, and it's at 4 o'clock, and I'll give you the reference at the end. So we take all of this construct and use it for Spaces Direct. And so as I mentioned, it's important because once I start running workloads in that hyperconverged configuration, the use of RDMA and devices like NVMe and SATA SSD gives us a great capability to provide performance in the form of IOPS and throughput like I described. But it also gives us the ability to deliver great capacity, because as we all know, hard drive capacities are growing, but the IOPS and throughput really aren't growing that much at all. So we can hold active workload in the cache devices, in that set of flash devices, and as that data set becomes cold, then we can essentially migrate it or move it out to the large capacity devices in the configuration. So with Spaces Direct, we not only created a hyperconverged storage configuration, but we allowed ourselves to use those cache devices, those flash configurations, as essentially local cache for each one of the nodes in that config. And so that gives us great performance, like I said, and adaptability to workloads. As the slide notes, we essentially, on a per-server behavior, will use those devices to cache reads and writes. And we do it in a way that will essentially move with the workload. So you don't have to fix or partition your workloads to match essentially the active data set. So I don't have to go pin a file to make sure that it's in flash. Once that file becomes active or that data becomes active, then it's going to be automatically pulled into the flash tier, and we're going to read and write from it as long as it stays active. One of the caveats, though, is that you have to size your physical devices to the active working set, meaning that you need to make sure that you've thought a little bit ahead. How much of my data is going to be active? Do I have a physical infrastructure that will support it? And over time, we'll provide the tools that will help us both as a provider and our OEMs to reach out to customers and get the sizing correct. But that's the one caveat to the configuration. So I talked a little bit about the fact that Spaces Direct allows for mirror parity, but there's a new capability in the Spaces Direct and REFS interaction called multi-resilient. So as you can see, mirror is typically for performance, parity is for capacity. So bringing those two together, we're able to take advantage of essentially mirrored capabilities. So that means that I got three copies of data that writes very easily, reads very easily, and the parity configuration. So parity is, you know, classic RAID type layout. So I get great capacity in the configuration. But when I update a stripe within a RAID volume, classic RAID volume, I have to read that whole stripe, update it, recalculate the parity, and then write that stripe back out. But with the multi-resilient tier, I overcome that, or multi-resilient volume, sorry. So what we've done here is that with the changes in REFS and Spaces Direct combined, REFS will read and write the active data into the mirror tier. So if I've got a piece of data that sits in a parity stripe, it gets updated or gets written to. REFS essentially notes that and will write just the modified data to the mirror tier. And as it sees other writes come in from that same stripe, it keeps writing the mirror tier, and then eventually makes the decision that, okay, I'll take that whole set, the data's become cold, or I need to move it out because of capacity, and rewrites it as a whole, just as a single stripe. So we get great throughput to the physical hard drives in a multi-resilient tier, because I've got the ability to stripe or essentially to write that sequentially instead of doing a bunch of random writes to those individual devices. And then you combine that with the way Spaces Direct does its caching to the individual flash devices in the servers. And not only do I get good performance from the multi-resilient tier, but that parity side gives me really great capacity as well. So we take advantage of that, or will take advantage of that in Azure Stack to give us that kind of performance and capacity play. So in Azure Stack, we'll use REFS, obviously, as I mentioned. We'll do one pool within the cluster, essentially one REFS file system per server. And this is to allow for essentially capacity expansion or ease the capacity expansion. So one of the things I haven't mentioned is that as an integrated system and the fact that all the storage within an Azure Stack solution gets consumed by the Azure Consistent APIs, essentially blob, tables, and queues, as an administrator, you really don't have to administer the storage. The platform essentially does that for you. So when I add a server to a scale unit, we will essentially automatically configure that, create that individual file system per server, and then essentially assume all the capacity into the system. Eventually, when we get to the point where we're supporting essentially removing capacity or If I have to remove a node with, from a scale unit, then it allows me to do that much more easily, and that I can take that individual scale unit, essentially decommission that file system, rebalance the storage with Spaces Direct, and then I can retire that server from the config. So this type of approach allows us to do that much more easily. We'll either use mirrored or, like I said, the multi-resilient volumes. And for hardware requirements for Spaces Direct, so everything that I mentioned before, compute and networking are required. And then I'm going to have two cache devices that can either be SATA SSD or NVMe devices. And then I'll have four or more, you know, essentially capacity devices. And those capacity devices either can be flash, so I can choose, you know, large, low drive writes per day SATA SSDs, or I can choose, you know, traditional hard drives for those configurations. Most likely you'll see hard drives because they're more cost effective at this point still, very large ones, and they'll probably be, you know, somewhere between 8 and 12 in the solution. You'll see those on the show floor if we go down and talk about them. So another area to just talk about briefly is the fact that Spaces Direct has brought in the health service. Like I said, spend your time at 4 o'clock and go, you know, see the Spaces Direct discussion. But this set of things are all of the type failure types or things that the health service brings together with Spaces Direct. So when we think about Spaces Direct and the fact that it's hyperconverged, really have to do a much better job about dealing with failures and identifying them effectively for the customer. And so this is the set. I've underlined the ones that are kind of the most prevalent, the things that would be most important for an Azure Stack instance. So, but those are things that we'll consume in our health monitoring capabilities. So I'm going to show you just briefly a slide that is stolen from a deck from tomorrow. So there's a session tomorrow afternoon about, or tomorrow at some point, we'll take a look at it in a second, for the infrastructure as a service capabilities. So this represents the blue boxes down below is everything I've discussed about how we put together physical infrastructure and build essentially that hyper-converged configuration. Everything on the top part of it is essentially how the Azure consistent storage services, so those blobs, tables, and queues, land on top of that physical infrastructure underneath. And as I mentioned, because we're Azure consistent, and that's the way you consume storage in Azure is through those APIs, then this is the set of services that really interact with the storage within an Azure Stack solution. So this gives you a view of, I have physical infrastructure, we build a resilient platform, I can scale up and down those resources through expansion and contraction, and then the ACS or the Azure Consistent Storage Services will run on top of that. So this is the set of things that we have yet to cover. So I'm going to go through and just talk about briefly each one of these and kind of fit into the pattern of, you know, the choices we've made for the underlying hardware and how this gets put together. So if you think about deployment, I've already talked about the fact that, you know, we're going to be doing, you do rack and stack, network switch configuration, as I mentioned. We have manual configuration of the switches, fit that into the border devices that you have in your config. And then the fact that we're actually deploy Azure Scale units individually, and then you'll connect to the Azure AD and ADFS. So if you went to Vijay Tiwari's session earlier today, you'll recognize this slide because he's identified essentially the same thing in picture diagrams. So I've got border, I have monitoring that might be instantiated in the solution, and then identity that we have to deal with, and obviously ping power and pipe are essentially the power that I need in space. So those things we have to work through, and that's, as I mentioned, we have a deployment technology for Azure Stack, so we essentially bare metal provision. So network switch is the only thing you have to do manually. Everything else is done automatically, meaning that we have the solution to do that initial deployment, bare metal all the servers, configure the SLBs to match the network configuration that you have, as I described before. And then we will then take care of the product, essentially full lifecycle, meaning that if I have to reprovision servers, then the same deployment capabilities that we used in initial deployment get used again when we have to redeploy servers over the lifetime of the solution. That'll include redeployment because of failure, but also new scale unit deployments as the solution moves forward. So just briefly about validation, I talked about the fact that we go through and are really rationalizing how we do not only requirements for hardware components, so we make sure that we get the RDMA NICs that we need for the solution, that they meet all the requirements that we have. And so we have a set of traditional Windows Server tests, referred to as the HLK, that we rely on. So those test individual components and servers, and we do that just for Windows Server in general. We'll do the same thing for Azure Stack. But then we think about the system as a whole. So we think about network switch configuration requirements that we have there, standing it up as a whole solution, and then validating it as a whole instead of as individual components. So we start off with those individual component validations, work with OEM partners on the solution BOM, and then we work on the overall validation for the configuration. So this is part of what we think of as is that life cycle, and we need to kind of move forward with the capabilities. If we talk about monitoring, so I'll bring back essentially the architectural slide that I had at the very beginning. So the idea is that compute and storage, that storage or S2D, the space's direct health service, we consume the events that come out of that from compute and storage and feed that back into the health service that's within the infrastructure of Azure Stack. So we consume that so we can event and alert around some of those things. Those same events can be pushed out, well, not the same events. So we also do agentless monitoring, so meaning that the individual hardware vendors are going to have to provide or will provide the capability of monitoring their hardware through the out-of-band processes. So that's another reason why the VMC connectivity is important, is that it allows those services to go off and extract essentially hardware state and health state and pull that out of the solution to an external monitoring capability. The network switches are the same. Since they're not included or automated, then we'll use monitoring from an SMP standpoint. And then finally, Azure Stack as itself will provide a RESTful API to our health resource provider, so you can consume in a standard way the set of events that are being thrown from the solution, so you can essentially pull that into things like Nagios or to Operations Manager if you want to consume those outside of the solution. And so there's a great session tomorrow afternoon on all of this, and I'll have a reference here at the end of the deck, so you can go and learn more about how this gets put together and how we'd actually manage and monitor the Azure Stack instance as well. So patch and update. So this is another area where obviously we traditionally have had Windows Server updates and other software updates, but we think of Azure Stack obviously as that entire integrated system. So that means that soup to nuts, so everything from firmware updates, from device drivers, all the way through the operating system to the services that run on top of that, is considered as essentially one deliverable package for Azure Stack. And so that'll be validated with our OEM partners. We essentially co-deliver that set of updates in a way that you can be assured that it's been validated against the solution that you have, but also deployed in a way that's non-disruptive to the active workloads. So meaning that we're going to have to go through, as I described at the very beginning, and update the physical host operating system. So that means that we have to manage the workload that's running on those, migrate them off, reimage the server, bring it back up, and bring it back into the solution. So that's one way we do manage that, and we'll do that for all of the services within that are delivered as part of Azure Stack. So the whole kit is managed and done in a way that's non-disruptive. So that's the goal for the program. So we'll deliver that as a patch and update. We also include backup and disaster recovery as kind of in that life cycle. One of the things to take away from this slide is that we are thinking of backup and disaster recovery in two major categories. One is the infrastructure, so we'll essentially back up the metadata and the infrastructure content and push that out of the solution essentially into an external file share so that you can back up that content with your own essentially backup choices, what your preferences are. And then the tenant workloads, they are backed up just as they would be in Azure, meaning that if you have a VM that's important or its data is important, then you're going to have a backup service that runs in that VM, or you'll use backup services that Azure provides or a third-party backup service. And so the same thing is going to be true of Azure Stack. And the whole point of this slide is to say that we're not going to have an integrated infrastructure at the very lowest layers, backup, kind of traditional on-premise backup capability, but will essentially create this separation and remain consistent with Azure from a, essentially what the backup characteristics are for in that space. And then finally, the security pieces of Azure Stack. So we think of this, again, kind of as a whole, making sure that, you know, we're using the best practices around, you know, Windows deployments from a security standpoint that we understand and rationalize, you know, making sure that we have patches, as I mentioned earlier, and how those are applied and managed, but also taking advantage of things like the just enough administration capabilities that we have in Windows Server 2016, that we're using RBAC to restrict access to the set of users that only need particular access. Network whitelisting, we are going to, you know, think through both, as I mentioned earlier, the ACLs and firewall rules for individual hosts or virtual ports, but also do the same for the physical switches, making sure that we have the right network and constraints of the overall configuration. So the other thing to note is that this is essentially on by default, meaning that we'll work to ensure that, you know, security is on and is aligned with the best practices for delivery overall. So to wrap up, have my email address, Twitter handle. These are the sessions that I've either had passed or coming up. I've highlighted a couple that are important. The one this afternoon at 4 o'clock, the space is direct. So if you're interested in all that content, please go see that session. There's the one tomorrow afternoon, becoming an Azure Stack infrastructure rock star. So we have the rock stars, at least one of them in the audience up front, so you can harass him. But that's where you go learn more about monitoring, how that's going to get put together. And then finally, I'm going to make a pitch for something that's not Azure Stack, but the session that's last on this list is a session that's going to talk about the essentially the Azure hardware capabilities that we are building and delivering to Open Compute. But also, there's supposed to be a discussion about the FPGA capabilities that we're using in Azure data centers and what that looks like, the announcement that we did earlier this week. And they'll go through some of the details and have examples of what that looks like. So if you're interested in that, you know, go see that. Obviously, IPT Pro. And the last thing I'm going to do is pitch evaluation. So usually, you get pitched on evaluations like, give me a really great score. The only reason I'm going to ask you for that is that I have to get a better score than my manager who did the presentation earlier today. So we have a friendly competition to figure out, you know, who can get the best rating. So please rate me high, and then I can give them a hard time about it next week when we get back in the office. Thank you very much.